This podcast is brought to you by DKP & Co. Chartered Accountants. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
And Athos, joining us now is The Guardian's Jonathan Howcroft. Jonathan, it's great to have you on the show once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Jonathan, I'll get straight to it. I feel like it's just been a massive past couple of days. Here we find ourselves talking about another crisis in the game, and many really continue to ask why a man who took the Matildas to their highest FIFA ranking and got them to a FIFA World Cup among many achievements really lost his job. And I think given the lack of transparency, people are assuming and speculating about things like hidden agendas. So one thing I want to ask you is, do you feel like this is a witch hunt?
Oh dear, that's a curly one to throw at me straight away. I'll try and be diplomatic and just begin by saying I don't think I have any more privilege and information than most people out there. I've read closely, I've made phone calls, but I definitely don't feel like I've got the full picture. And I think that's what's most troubling about this case, that there are clearly some people who have very strong opinions on one side. There are some people who have very strong opinions on the other. And the FFA has made an absolute shambles of trying to clarify what the situation actually is. And for as long as there's uncertainty, people will ask questions. People will jump to conclusions. And one of those conclusions is that there has been an agenda around Alan Stacic. And there have been some really fantastic pieces of writing over the last few days. This afternoon, Kevin Ayres wrote a really fantastic column that has a lot more new information in it and a very considered approach to it. And one of the conclusions from his piece would be that there probably has been an agenda. As for how we can conclusively prove that, I'm absolutely not in a position to go anywhere near that. Similarly, a piece from Andrew Webster in the Sydney Morning Herald that also indicates that may be a conclusion that we could draw. But from the lack of detail that the FFA provided, we're left in a realm of speculation, and that doesn't benefit anybody. It doesn't benefit the FFA. It doesn't benefit the Matildas. It absolutely doesn't benefit the coach who's lost his job. And it's now starting to reflect badly on individuals within FFA who may be perceived to have those agendas. So the whole thing, as Kevin very eloquently put, is a dumpster fire of the FFA's own making.
And it appears the FFA's role in this was very much epitomised by David Gallop's short and sweet press conference where he didn't really add anything new. He was quite vague. But Jonathan, one thing that hasn't really been touched on in all this was the fact that the FFA's Women's Council was not informed of the decision and found out on the day like the rest of us. Do you have any indication as to why this was the case?
I think they're still trying to figure out exactly what role the Women's Council has. And I think this is an indication of where it sits in the hierarchy. And I sympathise with Ros Moriarty, who tweeted her displeasure, I think would be a polite way of framing it, that she wasn't involved in that process and there wasn't a direct consultation. Now, the members of the Women's Council, independently, I'm pretty confident, will have had some involvement in it, but not under that umbrella, and I think that's the issue that needs to be addressed there. And the point that you raised about David Gallop's press conference and the initial press conference with the chairman alongside him as well, I mean, they're just wholly unconvincing public performances, and not the first wholly unconvincing public performance we've seen from David Gallop as chief executive. And one of the, referring back to the other excellent pieces of writing that have been on this subject, Richard Hines for the ABC wrote a column when this first came out, which was the FFA's message in all of this is trust us. something has happened. You don't need to know what. You probably can't find out what because of legalities and confidentiality, which would be standard workplace practices, one would presume. Just trust us. But we can't. We can't trust them because they don't have a track record of trust. They have a track record of abysmal communication and making decisions that appear to be shrouded in all sorts of difficulties. And this is just the latest in a string of them. So if this whole situation would have happened in a different organization, a different workplace, the outcome would be completely different. The outcome might well be, yeah, these leaders have a track record of being of showing that they deserve our trust in a situation where the details may, for other reasons, not be allowed to come out. But this isn't one of them. So either the details all come out and we can all make our judgment, or they don't, and we remain very sceptical about the process that's taken place.
And Jonathan, do you feel like there will be more transparency on this in the coming days or weeks?
If there is, I don't think it will be by design. I think it will be because so many people are now digging around. There are so many disgruntled parties. There are leaks all over the place. There are leaks in places that we don't normally see them for these kind of things. And I think it would it's just very, very hard once momentum like this happens for all the information not to eventually eke its way out. It's just a case of who controls the message, and at the moment no one's controlling it, which is why it feels like there's just absolute chaos.
And just taking a step back and looking at this through the lens of more so the context of sport in Australia, we saw this decision was potentially influenced by the results of the Our Watch survey and the PFA survey. And we saw a similar thing happen with Cricket Australia, where a survey then resulted to a drastic change. So is this kind of thing the way forward in Australia sports? Do you see other governing bodies looking to these examples when they need to make change?
Yeah, so this is it's a really interesting topic that you raise, and I feel like it's been given it's been a bit dismissed from a lot of people. If there is an issue, if there is a genuine problem, and that is one of the tools, if a survey is a tool that can be used to get to the root of the problem, I don't see why any of us would have a problem with it. And equally, in this case, if those surveys revealed something of concern that has to be addressed immediately, then the fact that it's a survey, I've got no issue with. I going back to the issue of trust, I would trust that the experts in that field have refined their techniques to adequately satisfy the problem. I think what we have here is issues about who was involved at what time, what prompted the involvement, what the actual response rate was, how specific the responses were in relation to the overall playing group, and how much could have been drawn from them. And all of which, for the time being, remains without an explicit answer from head office, which is why everybody's making their own conclusions around the margins. And like I say, the piece this afternoon from Kevin Ayres goes into a lot more detail than I think we've seen previously. And it doesn't how to put it diplomatically, it doesn't leave you with the impression that the process was as robust as one might have hoped for such a significant announcement. But then that has to be positioned against some of the comments that have come from people with more information, absolutely, than I've got, saying that if we knew what the transgressions were, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. It's just a case of the situation is dealt with and we move on. But we don't all have that information, and the process appears to have appears to be a very convoluted and not particularly clear one. So we're left scratching our heads.
Oh, it has just been a PR disaster, Jonathan. And I mean, as you say, the fact that we don't have actual proper hard facts, everything is basically left to interpretation. But something that's been thrown around and obviously spoken about in FFA's press conferences is the fact that there is this toxic culture within the Matildas camp and setup. What do you think, and how do you interpret that? And what do you think is acceptable behaviour? And do you think there should be maybe a different standard for the men's and women's team?
Yeah, there's some really good questions in there. What do I think about it? I think that it's convenient that the coach can be held responsible for that culture and not the head of high performance or the head of women's football or the chief executive, where that's where culture originates. So it feels like a bit of a get out catch all for what I'm expecting will be very specific issues that will be addressed. What is acceptable? I'm not sure. I'm sympathetic to the argument that there are different rules for high performance. I don't know. I think I can be persuaded either way. Workplaces have to, whether it's a football team or an office or whatever, workplaces have to be safe environments for staff to perform at their best. But clearly there is something very specific about the high performance environment. As for different standards between men's and women, I'm so far out of my depth trying to answer that. I don't know. I don't really know where I'd begin. Clearly, bringing my maleness into the answer, some of the suggestions, in particular skin folds, don't feel controversial to me. But that's not to say that they're not controversial and shouldn't be given their own specific context in a women's football environment. So I'd be very reluctant to put my neck out on the line for that one. But it just all feels, without knowing the very specifics, it all feels a bit too neat how these conclusions have been reached and how they've been framed. And until we get the details of what what the charge sheet looks like, it inevitably leads us to think that there are other agendas at play.
And one thing that I think we can all agree on, and the one thing that we do know, is that the Matildas need a coach and need a coach quickly. And Jonathan, one person you've done a bit of work with is Lisa Alexander, the Diamonds coach, Australia's netball coach. Do you think she's someone who's got that pedigree and that respect around Australia who the FFA should look to head a new coaching selection panel, considering she's quite independent to all this?
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent point to raise. I think she would be a fantastic person to involve in that process. And Lisa and the Diamond, they've built their brand around culture for a number of years now. So irrespective of results, a lot of their focus is on behaviour and attitude and presenting themselves in a certain way and results following as a consequence of that, which seems exactly like the kind of thing FFA are looking for at the moment in respect to the Matildas. And Lisa's someone who has used leading teams quite a lot. And I saw that in one of the reports in the News Limited papers that Ray McLean was name-checked in a conversation about sporting culture. Absolutely, Lisa would be the kind of person that I think would add a lot of value to a process like this.
Jonathan, do you think that this whole saga that is going on right now is undermining our bid for the FIFA Women's World Cup in 2023?
Well, it can't help it. I think that's the only way that I'd put it. Whether how much it's undermining it, I'm not sure. I would think that the decisions over hosting rights for something for a tournament like this are on a much bigger scale. It's about finance and logistics and growing the game on an international scale. This is a very domestic issue, and like I say, it's not the kind of thing that reflects well, but I don't think it's the kind of thing that would necessarily put a black mark against the bin.
And just switching over to the A-League now, Jonathan, we've reached the halfway point of the season, and I personally can't help feeling a bit ambivalent towards what's happened so far, because on the one hand, we have such a tight race at the top of the table, and Perth Glory and Victory and Sydney all playing fantastic football. But on the other hand, the top six is just about locked in, barring a Newcastle Jets miracle.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like you might have read my column from this week. There's certain similarities with the conclusions that I've drawn. So, it's the frustration of a final system, isn't it? But it gives you something to aim for at the end of the season, but also it could mean that once it's established who those likely finalists are, it reduces a certain element of interest. I also think that the Premier's Plate race is probably going to ebb out reasonably quickly once Sydney and Melbourne Victory get involved in the Asian Champions League. I think Perth's depth of squad and Tony Popovich is just relentless approach as a coach. I think that will be over sooner rather than later in Perth's favour. And obviously, because we don't have relegation, there isn't anything to worry about at that end of the table either. So it could be quite a long drag to the finish line this year. And I guess we just have to hope that the finals bring it all back to life again when we get to the business end.
And Perth Glory, for the second year in a row, have been that team which has really just come out of nowhere and not necessarily surprised everyone, but they've gone from finishing nowhere the year before and now on the top of the table. We saw it with Newcastle last season. Is it possible for someone like a Brisbane, who is a very proud club, to be able to do this as well?
Yeah, absolutely is. I don't think Perth have done anything mysterious. They've gone out and got arguably the best Australian coach. They've gone out and bought half a dozen Socceroos. They've built a really strong core. They've backed in senior players. And the outcome is there for all to see. I don't think it's a particularly challenging assignment. The challenge is fitting it all in the salary cap and making sure that that you can balance your squad effectively. You look at using Perth as an example, Luke Reddy, Neil Kilkenny, Andy Keogh, and they already had a couple of top class centre halves. So you've got your spine there to begin with, and then they fill in the gaps around the outside. I don't see any reason why any other team isn't able to do that. It just depends on the priorities. So take Melbourne City, for example. Their be-all and end-all isn't winning silverware in the domestic competition. That's part of what they're here to do. But they're also here to develop young players and sell them on as part of the City Football Group ownership model. And that's why Lockie Wales was brought in. That's why Nathaniel Atkinson plays consistently, because that's part of what they're there to accomplish. Would they both be in the first 11 in a Perth Glory Tony Popovich situation? I doubt it, based on week in week out performances. I'm sure they won't be far away from the squad, but it just goes to show how just a slight tweaking of incentives can completely change it all. We saw it with Graham Arnold at Sydney FC. He was there to pick experienced players and win football matches. There wasn't a lot of youth development focused in on that. I think it all just depends on where each club feels like they're at a particular time and what their priorities are.
And that's exactly right, Jonathan. I mean, with Graham Arnold at Sydney FC, he barely rotated his starting 11. We didn't even really see any young players come into the fold. But now he is the head coach of the Socceroos, and they're through to the quarterfinals. Some mixed results. I know, Jonathan, from past discussions that, you know, you were in favour of Graham Arnold kind of getting the job because it fit in with having, you know, an Australian coach, an Australian team. Do Do you think that your mind has changed having him as coach now, given some of the recent performances at the Asian Cup, or are you still quite comfortable that he's the right man for the job?
Yeah, I'm absolutely comfortable. My opinion on whether an Australian should be the coach hasn't changed. And I can't imagine it ever would. And I think he was the best credentialed at the point that there was an that the role became available. So that's I've not seen anything since then to make me really question that. He's been hamstrung in this tournament. I thought some of the pre-tournament friendly performances were really quite exciting. But not having Aaron Moy, not having Matthew Leckie, not having Martin Boyle, still not having a focal point at number nine. I think he's been let down a little bit with the form and fitness of players in other positions as well. I mean, Trent Sainsbury's, we know that he's capable of a much higher standard than we've seen in recent months. So I think things haven't necessarily gone his way. And sometimes tournament football is just about getting it done. And so far, they have got it done. It's not always been particularly pretty. They clearly started poorly, but they've improved since then. And the Uzbekistan game, as dull as it was, they did enough. They never really looked like they were going to concede. Absolutely, they lacked a spark of inspiration up front. And without Tom Rogic for the quarterfinal, I think that problem is going to be compounded. So it will be a test of his coaching ability to solve that problem. But as a whole, I would say that what we've seen and where they are right now is probably about par. And if they can get past the UAE, I think that would be an excellent tournament.
And Jonathan, just a word on Matty Ryan. Isn't he a true national hero?
He's outstanding. And I was just talking to somebody else today, actually, about him. I feel like he's on the cusp of elevating himself into that top echelon of international footballer, with all respect to Brighton, and I don't mean to make this sound as patronising as I'm sure Brighton fans will feel like this sounds. This is his intermediary club. He's done his trade in the A-League. He got his opportunity in Europe. He took it. This is his step to prove to the bigger clubs that he can handle it at the highest level. And you think that he's now within, I don't know, a 6 to 18 month window where his stock is high enough for him to get a really exciting move. And I think if that comes to fruition and he takes it, we'll start regarding him right up there with the very best soccerers of all time.
That's exactly right. And it was only Jurgen Klopp the other day who was speaking really quite highly of Matty Ryan and saying what an outstanding goalkeeper he was. So watch this space. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I'm familiar with Klopp's comments. He was linked to Man United not too long ago as well. All I would just hope is that he takes a number one job. He doesn't accept a number two position or one of those roles where the number one jersey isn't nailed on and there's a couple of them competing for it. I just hope that he backs himself and waits for the right opportunity, not just any opportunity.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us on Evenings on FNR, and we really appreciate you taking out the time to come on the show, and we look forward to chatting to you again at the same time next week.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.